From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. The Colville Cooperative Observer Network Station was established in 1974 to aid forecasting operations for the National Weather Service. Margaret Bowman and her husband, Duane, took the helm in 1987, and together they gathered weather observations every single day for the past 30 years until Margaret's retirement in 2017.
Recognizing 30 years of dedication, the National Weather Service has named Margaret Bowman of Colville a 2017 recipient of the John Campanius Holm Award for Outstanding Service as a Weather Observer. This award is one of the agency's most prestigious, with only a maximum of 25 earned nationwide each year by deserving weather observers throughout the country. Margaret Bowman and Lisa Verzella, the observation program leader with the National Weather Service, join us in the second half of the show.
But before that, we're going to run through some news items that we've been meaning to share with you these last few weeks, including the news that 2017 was the second warmest year on record, according to NASA, and the White House is reopening up a number of leases off the coast of the Atlantic and Pacific Coast to... Any guess?
to
solar and wind? No.
To solar and wind.
To oil and gas drilling. We'll cover that. And we have some other things, right?
Additionally, last week, the EPA reversed longstanding guidance that helps limit hazardous pollution such as mercury, lead, arsenic from major sources like power plants and large industrial facilities. And this sort of reversed guidance could lead to a significant increase in toxics in the air.
All right, we'll cover that in the first part of the show. Remember, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our email address, thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Our connections with and impacts upon the environment. That's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report every weekday at 6:50 and 7:50 during the morning news with Leslie Thatcher. Brought to you in part by Big D Construction, DeJoria Center at High Star Ranch, and Esco Heating, Air Conditioning, Plumbing, and Electrical. That's Esco, ESCO. Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on the environment and our relationship and impacts with the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And first of all, it's good to be back after
That's right.
our break during Sundance.
We had a brief hiatus during the Sundance reel.
Yes. I didn't get to see any films this year.
It was
because I wasn't.
Because you were out of town.
I forgot. I was out of town. So I missed that. But I hear it was a great event and great success as always. And we're back. We got some interesting guests the second half of the show talking about weather observations and how citizen science
That's right.
makes a huge difference with the National Weather Service. So we'll be speaking with Lisa Verzelli of the National Weather Service and Margaret Bowman. She is an award winner of the National Weather Service Award for the John Campanius Home Award for Outstanding Service as a Weather Observer. All that coming in the second half of the show. But first half, let's cover some news items, including this first one. This happened almost a couple weeks ago now, but the White House announced that it was going to allow new offshore oil and gas drilling in nearly all U.S. coastal waters, giving energy companies access to leases off California for the first time in decades, and opening more than a billion acres in the Arctic and also along the Atlantic eastern seaboard. Now, the Interior Department would open 25 of 26 regions of the outer continental shelf, leaving only the North Aleutian Basin, which President George Bush protected in an executive order, exempted from drilling. These lease sales, the Interior official said there will be 47 lease sales between 2019 and 2024, so it's still a few years away, and it'll probably be challenged by environmental groups and also states, particularly along the eastern seaboard. States along the eastern seaboard, whether they have Democratic governors or Republican governors, do not like the idea of seeing oil rigs
off
their coast.
Well, as demonstrated in Florida.
Yeah. Interesting enough, while I was in Florida doing some research, a number of these leases are in the eastern, there's 12 of leases in the eastern Gulf of Mexico that would be off the west coast of Florida. And those have always been off the table. Great efforts by Florida government officials and agencies to make sure that there were no oil rigs off the coast of Florida, but there is perhaps oil there. And there's also the infrastructure in place in the central Gulf of Mexico to reach eastern Gulf of Mexico, right?
There's always seemed to be enough concern about fisheries, tourism,
recreation. Boating, and so
that's kind of been off the table.
So there's a lot of pushback but this announcement opened up 12 areas for leasing off the west coast of Florida. So what did the Florida governor do? He got very concerned. And this is an opinion here. Having lived in Florida during this governor's reign, Governor Scott, who is a staunch Republican, he's no friend of the environment. Okay. Environmental field, he's not an environmental advocate. But suddenly, with the announcement of these leases, he became an environmentalist and contacted the Department of Interior and see what he can do. And he's also running for Senate, or in 2019. So what happened? Well, Ryan Zinke, the head of the Department of Interior, flew down to Tallahassee, where they met. He met with the governor for, as the Tampa Bay Tribune cited, roughly between 20 and 30 minutes. After that meeting, Ryan
it's a
Zinke
long flight
got back
for
in his jet, flew back
meeting.
To the, yeah, and the governor announced that the leases off the west coast of Florida are off the table for now. Okay, so that's the kind of pushback that a lot of this is getting.
So interesting to see that, though, from kind of both sides of the political spectrum.
Yeah. And like I say, there are governors up and down the eastern seaboard who do not, and mayors who have coastal towns who do not want to see oil rigs. And here's the thing. Here's one interesting side that based on the most recent data, and this is 20, 30, 40 years old in some cases, it's estimated that there's about 5 billion barrels of oil off the Atlantic coast. Now, what's our math? Now, remember, how many times do I have to remind you?
How many times do we have to go through
these
calculations,
how
Chris?
How much oil do we consume here in the U.S. every day? 20 million barrels. So how many days does it take to get to a billion barrels? If it's at 20 million barrels a day, divide that into a billion, and you get 50 days. Thank you. So every 50 days, we here in the U.S., consume a billion barrels of oil. Okay. What is 5 billion barrels then? How many days would it take to consume 5 billion? You have this Planet X stare.
You're just going. You're just run with it, Chris.
Let me just
250 days.
Very good. It would take 250 days for the U.S. to consume 5 billion barrels. That's what's estimated to be off the Atlantic coast. 250, less than 1 year's worth of inventory is what's off the Atlantic coast.
And when you think about the long-term implications of the drilling itself, the potential risks and implications.
Yeah. Is it worth it? So that's how it sounds like a lot when people say 5 billion barrels of oil. Well, in terms of how much we consume here in the U.S., not globally, because we consume a billion barrels on a global basis every 10 days.
Ooh.
Yeah. So that's the kind of work that's going on. That's how much oil there. Put things in perspective. And again, my friend who works in the oil business says that when they look at the oil map, they don't see 5 billion barrels here and 2 billion barrels over in this reserve. They see it in terms of how much it'll cost to get that oil out of the ground. And nothing's going to happen along the Atlantic coast, off the Atlantic coast, he said, until oil gets back well over $100 a barrel. That's where their break-even costs are. So all of this is happening. Back to the lease. That's the lease information going on. But they're opening up leases for sale starting in 2019 off the Pacific coast and in the Arctic.
Do we anticipate seeing any other states protest this? And
California,
try to get
of course,
deals?
Washington, Oregon. They're all not interested in seeing oil rigs. The Gulf, they already got lots. But there's lots of leasing going on there anyway.
Yeah.
Arctic. That's a big challenge. And it's all going to be challenged in court. So that's what's happening with Department of Interior and leasing programs for oil. We'll keep you appraised. So what does that mean in terms of our air quality now?
Interesting question, Chris.
Yes.
Especially in relation to last week's announcement. The EPA reversed a longstanding guidance that helps limit hazardous pollution like mercury, lead, arsenic, benzene. I think there are like 1,000 or 1,500 chemicals listed on this that are they're referred to as toxics. And it would limit them specifically from major sources. So that's power plants, large industrial facilities, and then also vehicles overall, like as a whole. And so that has the potential to significantly increase these toxics in our air quality. And there's kind of an environmental justice theme to this as well, because when we think about where these large industrial facilities and where the majority of this pollution is happening, you really do get into an environmental justice issue as well. So there's a lot of concern that this will impact, at-risk communities much more than other folks.
Low
right?
economic
like, mm-hmm.
scale.
Yep.
Right.
So the way that this would happen is that... And here's where it gets a little complicated, but these big sources are referred to as major sources,
mm-hmm.
And there's a certain cap. So if they're going to release more than 10 tons of one toxic in a year or 15 tons overall, they are classified as a major, and they have to implement these the best possible technology. So they have to have the best techniques on the market in order to decrease this. And the policy is once in, always in. So if you can release more than that, then this policy is going to require that you always have the best possible technology.
Okay.
What this rollback is saying is that, you know what, as long as you can keep it under that cap, you don't need to have the best possible technology.
Oh.
So places, facilities that fall under that cap will be able to actually increase the amount that they're releasing of these toxics into the environment up to that cap.
Okay. And so, I'm sorry, are they planning to raise this cap?
They are not planning to raise the cap.
To infinity?
So the cap will stay. Yes. The cap will stay where it is.
Okay.
And there's sort of an, I don't know if you would call it an argument or a statement from the folks that implemented this at the EPA, that this would incentivize, and I'm not sure I follow this, but this would incentivize businesses, facilities that fall above this cap to try to decrease down to the cap so that they no longer have to have the best technology.
Right.
They no longer have to pay for that on there. you know, that new technology as it comes out. So there's some question there. However, it seems like in the balance here, there'll probably be more release.
Or perhaps you can run these facilities in a manner that still produces the product you're looking to produce, let's say benzene, but your emissions will be decreased in such a way that it's below the cap, but you just manage the operations to lower the total emissions.
Right.
Okay.
So, excuse me, it's an interesting move, and the general assessment of this from the science community is that this will have a significant decrease in air quality. Rather than going through EPA's rulemaking process, this is just sort of considered, they're considering it new guidance, and it was presented in such a way that it seems like it'll just become like a de facto rule.
Sure.
And so that'll just be, you know, that'll be effective immediately. So it remains to be seen what exactly happens here. But one interesting piece is that Bill Wareham, who's the assistant administrator of EPA's Office of Air and Radiation, he's been actually trying to do this same thing since like the early 2000s, maybe 2007. And so now that he's back in the EPA with this administration, that's kind of the motivation for this happening.
Okay.
So,
yeah. Doesn't surprise.
There's
me.
Major
lots of motivation.
Concern. Every large environmental group is focusing on this. So, like you said about the last announcement, there are going to be, you know,
lots
significant
of
attention and lawsuits. And if you're interested, you can hop online and find endless information.
I'm
about
sure you can
this.
Go to the NRDC website and find out more about that.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that is interesting is that the current guidance that was just reversed. Has caused significant reductions in harmful air pollutants that cause serious health problems over the past two decades when it's been in action. And so I think that's also what people are basing their predictions, that we'll see an increase with this rollback.
Yeah. Quite possibly.
Yeah. And it's not just the, you know, we often talk about like the impacts of air pollution, say in Salt Lake, and we talk about, you know, the respiratory issues and asthma and hospital visits, and it can impact your cardiovascular system. But a lot of these toxics also can cause like heart and lung diseases, cancer.
Right. Some are suspected, if not known, carcinogens, like benzene, which is a known carcinogen.
Right.
So there are a lot of comments. And you said there's thousands of chemicals in play, of which are not all of them, not even nearly all of them, are even monitored. Or required to be monitored. You know, they have primary pollutants that they monitor for. All right, so that's what's going on in our air world.
So pay attention to that one. Keep an eye out. This just happened, so it'll be interesting to see what happens in the coming weeks. We may get distracted by another dire issue if the past months have been any indication.
But. Well, speaking of which, as we kind of wrap up this news news component of our show, scientists at NASA last week ranked last year as the second warmest year on record since record keeping began in 1880. And what year was the warmest year on record? Now?
The previous year?
Yeah, 2016.
Wild guess there. Yeah.
And what year is in third and fourth?
The next
2015
year,
and 2014. Year. Yes. So now, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, which uses a slightly different analytical method, ranked 2016 third. So it's second or third, depending if you believe NASA or NOAA. It's all the same. What's most important, that it's the warmest year on record without an El Nino situation. Remember, we had an El Nino situation last year, which tends to make things, the planet, a little warmer. And that's why, and part of the reason why 2017 was the warmest year on record. But 2016, no El Nino, and still the second or third warmest year on record. That, to me, is pretty significant.
Yeah.
That's the new normal that we're in. And that's what Gavin Schmidt actually says. He's the director of Goddard Institute for Space Studies. He says, quote, this is the new normal. But he says it's also changing. It's not that we've gotten to a new plateau. This isn't where we'll stay. In 10 years, we're going to say, oh, look, another record decade of warming temperatures. So Gavin is suggesting that this decade will probably be the warmest one on record. We only got, what, 2 more years in this decade. And it's already probably going to be the warmest. We can comfortably say it'll be the warmest decade on record. But it's Gavin Schmidt is suggesting that next decade will be even warmer than this one, and so on and so forth. So that's what's going on. In fact, and the last thing, 17 of the 18 warmest years since modern record keeping has begun have occurred since 2001, which, my math, is only 17 years ago. So nearly every year since 2001 has been in the top 17 warmest years. So that's what's going on. And now we're going to be talking a little more about the weather.
That's right. And these, you know, observations locally as far as temperature. It'll be interesting to learn.
And how citizen science plays a big role in collecting weather data and reporting it and cataloging it, and how it helps the National Weather Service. So I think we're going to be
take a quick break, and then we'll be back with Lisa Verzella, the Observation Program Leader with the National Weather Service, as well as Margaret Bowman, our local National Weather Service observer.
All right. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain instructors share their love of skiing and snowboarding with guests, helping them improve their skills and enjoy the mountain. More information on Ski and Snowboard School and other programs at parkcitymountain.com.
Hello, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage pickup provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Garbage and recycling containers should be placed at the curb before 7 a.m. on your scheduled collection day. Keep Summit County green. SummitCounty.org/recycle.
This is Stephanie, store manager at Jan's, a proud sponsor of KPCW. Jan's carries skis from brands like Atomic, Fisher, and Kessley, plus custom boot fitting to ensure boot comfort on the slopes. We also offer rentals of snowshoes, snowboards, and clothing. Jan's Mountain Outfitters, 649-4949 or jans.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show on environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. I'm Chris Cherniak.
I'm Nell Larson.
And joining us in studio is Lisa Verzella. She is the Observations Program Leader with the National Weather Service. She's works down in Salt Lake City.
Yes.
I assume. And thank you for coming up to Park City.
Well,
in
thank
the studio
you for having me.
For this segment. And we're going to be getting Margaret Bowman on the line. She's the recipient of the John Campanius Home Award for Outstanding Service as a weather observer, and she lives in Colville. And we'll talk to her a little more about the work that she's been doing for the last, and her husband doing for the last 30 years. But Lisa, let's start here. Talk about the importance that citizen science plays in helping to collect data that the National Weather Service otherwise would have a challenge doing.
Yeah, absolutely. This is a program, it's called the Cooperative Observer Program, and it officially began in 1890. Before that, there had been a number of observations, starting with John Campanius Home himself, who's the first recorded colonial patriot who came over to
the first recorded recorder.
Who took observations in the mid-1600s. And then observations were taken by Thomas Jefferson, Benjamin Franklin, George Washington. And in fact, when Jefferson started in 1776, he had some of the longest records. And he kind of started the movement to get basically citizen scientists, although they weren't called that back then, on board to take local weather measurements in their hometowns. And that program expanded to where it became an official program in 1890 with the Weather Bureau, and incorporates people from all over the country. Now we have about 10,000 observers from farms, urban, rural areas. We have one here in Park City at the library. sheriff's offices, schools, any organization that can take daily weather observations every day for decades.
So tell us, tell us a little bit about the Colville station that we also have here locally and when that was installed and the role of that location.
Okay, yeah, the Colville station was set up, and that's it's quite a bit east of the town of Colville, kind of in the higher terrain there. So the precipitation measurements are pretty important for climate, for stream flow, for predictions. And Margaret and her husband hopped on board in the mid-1980s, and Margaret took over and has been doing it for almost 30 years, just retired this year,
right.
So we are looking for a new observer.
Well, let's take a minute. We've got Margaret on the phone.
Great.
And so Margaret Bowman, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
And congratulations on receiving the John Campanius Home Award for your weather observations.
Well, it's been interesting, you know.
So tell us what motivated you to start helping with this and to commit so much time to it over the years.
I don't know. I guess not much else to do up here, so I'm just kind of interested in it, you know.
Well, what was it that you did or had to do almost every day you collected this data? What was that data that you were collecting?
Well, we had the weather and if there was rain or snow, you know, the measurements on it.
And was that once a day or did you have to do it multiple times a day? So once a day.
Oh, once a day.
And Lisa, is there a certain time of day that you like that data to be collected?
Most of the observers, they either commit to a morning or an evening observation.
I usually in the morning around noon or something like that.
Okay.
And so is this location close to where you live? Is it easy to access? Describe the spot. Yeah. Give us a description of the location.
Describe the location.
Oh, describe the location up here?
Yes.
Well, we're like 20 minutes from Colville, and we've got a big ranch here, and they've got the weather station, or had it set up here, like in my backyard. And I just had to go out and get it, you know, every day.
Right. So back in 1987 or so when you first started, how was that information sent in? Was it literally phoned in or how did you do that?
I kept track of it and then we had to turn, the paper in once a month.
Yeah, Margaret was always great about mailing in her observations once a month. And that's how a lot of observers did it back in the, until about the 90s or so when the computer entry kind of became more standard. But we still have a number of observers that write it down, and at the end of the month, they just mail in their forms and send their data in, you know, like clockwork like Margaret did.
Right, and so literally your office would receive mail, the folders or so, envelopes of monthly, and then somebody had to sit there and enter in all this data.
Yep.
That's the way it was done back in the 80s. Now it's all online?
It's not all online. I'd say about 90%. And then there's still folks there's a lot of folks out in rural areas that still don't have great internet access.
Right.
We have a number of older observers as well that have been doing it a certain way for years and like to, and we encourage that. So there's a certain amount of, you know, mail we have to go through every month, and I quality control about 100 different stations when they come in every single month, whether it's by mail or online.
So, Margaret, what changes have you noticed over the time that you've been doing this?
I don't know as far as the weather is concerned. It seems about the same, you know, to me every year. I can remember one year, I don't know why this sticks in my mind, but it was 24 below zero.
Wow.
And it's never been, you know, that bad before, but that just kind of sticks in my mind because it was really, but it's cold up here all the time anyway.
Right.
That's an incredibly low temperature to find up in the hills above Colville.
Right. Right.
Yes.
And but one interesting thought is that if Margaret's collecting this data once a day, you know, consistently around noon, you need to have that consistency.
Yes.
That only captures the weather at that time of day. So in the event that there is a rainstorm later in the afternoon, how does that get worked into your calculations and observations?
Yeah, the observation is actually a 24-hour observation. So that includes your precipitation in
okay.
the past 24 hours.
Okay, not an instantaneous
right,
thing.
Right,
okay.
So it includes your snowfall, your water content, and then it's a record of your maximum and minimum temperatures within that 24 hours. So every day is tracked.
Wow. How about wind speed and wind direction? Is that track? Or is that another level of?
That's not part of the co-op program. There are several stations out there, and the National Weather Service monitors a lot of that information. But the co-op program itself is just precipitation and temperature.
Okay.
Now, before we move on to the larger picture of the program, it sounds like you're looking for a new observer in this same area outside of Colville. Is that right?
Yes, we are. It's a pretty rural, remote, sparse area, so it's difficult to find people. And these days, it's tough to find people that are home every day and willing to do this.
Ah, so who do they contact if someone's listening? They might be interested.
Well, I'd say in that region, maybe 10 to 15 miles east of Colville, if you know some folks that are around that are kind of weather nerds, we seem to have a lot of them out there these days, or somebody interested in becoming a citizen scientist. I like to call them weather patriots.
Weather patriots, okay.
I like that.
They can contact the National Weather Service in Salt Lake City.
Okay.
And just express their interest. And my name, again, is Lisa Verzella, and somebody will get you to me if they have an interest.
And again, what is the requirements?
An interest in weather is very helpful, but basically you'd be taking precipitation and weather and temperature observations every day about the same time. There are methods to, you know, if you have to go away for a weekend or skip a few days. And then we like to have kind of, if you have a family or a partner or somebody that can take backup observations for you. Somebody that's just interested in daily weather and helping promote tracking climate and, wants to help out and take these observations every day and is a pretty dedicated person.
Well, we like to think we have a good track record on this front because a few years ago we talked about the need for a new Park City weather mm-hmm. observer, and we ended up getting a home for that at the library.
At the library.
Yes.
And so hopefully one of our listeners is interested or knows somebody who might be interested or could reach out to others who might potentially be interested in this.
Yeah, that's great. We also had a Colville proper station like around the town of Colville, and several years ago that was closed. So I would like to reopen that station as well if there's somebody in town.
Okay.
All right. Again, so they can get in touch with you, your email address?
Yes, lisa.verzella, so that's L-I-S-A, dot V as in victory, E-R, Z as in zebra, E-L-L-A, at NOAA.gov, N as in Nancy, O-A-A, dot G-O-V.
Okay. I'll tell you what, let's take a little break. I want to thank Margaret, first of all. Margaret, thank you so much for taking the time to come on our show this morning.
Oh, that was great. I just hope that I didn't sound stupid answering some
no.
of your questions.
No, you sounded great. And thank you for your service. 30 years of collecting weather data. That's fantastic. And it's much appreciated. And the National Weather Service really relies heavily on citizens like yourself to collect this data that they otherwise can't. So you played a critical role, and that's why you deserve that award that you received. So thank you again for that.
Yes, thank you, Margaret.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. I tell you what, let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to continue the conversation on citizen science, the role they play, not just in maybe weather collection, but maybe in some other areas that the National Weather Service needs data. So if you can hang around, Lisa?
Absolutely.
All right. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
All
right. Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com. And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Find, friend, and follow KPCW Radio on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We're bringing news, information, and photos from across the Wasatch back to the sites you use every day. Find out first by connecting with KPCW's social side.
Hi, I'm Monica Van Hartesfeld, branch manager of U.S. Bank in Park City and proud supporter of Park City High School sports on KPCW. Located on the corner of Park Avenue and Deer Valley Drive, we offer consumers small business and commercial banking services. USBank.com or 435-647-3726.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And in the studio with us is Lisa Verzella, the Observations Program Leader with the National Weather Service here in Utah. And she's here to talk about their observations program, as well as a local Colville resident who just received the John Holm Award for Outstanding Service as a Weather Observer. But let's circle a little bit back toward the network that you have here in the state. So you have quite an extensive group of people throughout the state that are collecting these observations every day. How do you decide on the locations of these stations and seek out these people?
Well, the initial program set up kind of guidelines that they wanted at least one site every 25 miles
or so,
across the country. And, you know, here in the mountains, you can have something that's a quarter of a mile apart and be very different weather. So there were stations set up over the years, and the program that I inherited, I've been trying to kind of fill in the gaps a little bit on some of the data. If an area, mountainous area, can be blocked by radar, or I'm sorry, there's radar blockage from the mountains, so we don't see all of the data on the radar with our instruments. So that's where ground truth is really helpful. There are a lot of areas with some flash flooding, for instance, in Price and Spanish Fork areas where we don't have a lot of good data that's already online. So those are places where it's important to kind of reach out to people and say, hey, do you mind putting a station in your yard or with your organization and have somebody monitor this? And not only that for daily or monthly, but they give us calls as well when they have like a flash flood or severe thunderstorms or big hazardous weather.
And how many observers do you have here in the state of Utah?
Well, we actually cover most of Utah. Our National Weather Service area that we cover is in most of Utah, basically from Green River all the way to the west, to the border of Nevada.
Okay.
And then also an area of southwest Wyoming. So up in Uinta County. So we have we have quite an extensive area. And we have about 100 observers all over that area.
Wow.
And again, this is all volunteer. They're not being paid anything.
Correct.
This is just they give their time and their effort, their energy to collect this data. Okay. And is there other science-based programs? Are citizens collecting other types of data, say other climatological data out there?
Well, in our office, there's a program called Skywarn. It has incorporates many of the co-op observers themselves, but also members of the public. We train them to take observations for more imminent weather, and they will call in, or we can call them about anything that's imminent. Like I said, with flash flooding or wind damage, there's lightning, big storms, big hail dropping, anything that could be kind of imminent to the public. And that information allows us to create warnings on the spot and, of course, helps us with future forecasts.
Does a person have to pass any type of test or any type of requirements other than, like you say, to be obviously available and committed to doing this?
Yeah.
But otherwise, is there an age limit?
There's no age limit. We accept citizen scientists of all types. We just do ask them to go through the training so they are aware, and we have some kind of baseline so everybody's reporting similar things.
Okay.
Now, with the data from the, you know, ongoing Cooperative Observer Program, obviously that's not used for these imminent kind of dangers. How is that integrated into the forecasting and record keeping?
Well, the fact that they have been taking records for so long, decades. I have some observers approaching 50 years.
Wow.
And institutions over 100 years.
Wow.
And that information helps not only define the climate of the area around it, like Utah's climate, basically, but it also helps track long-term climate changes. You know, and I have heard from many observers in different parts of the state that they've noticed changes, and so their data gets incorporated into the long-term record, and then the National Climate Environmental Institute takes this data, quality checks it further, and then can compile a scientific record to track the climate changes over time.
It's a really neat opportunity to participate. You know, we talk about citizen science a lot, and some of these projects are a little bit, I don't know, softer than others. With something like this, that's a pretty lasting impact. It's pretty neat.
Right. And these changes, that observations that they're seeing, trends, is that both temperature and precipitation? Is there any way to? Okay.
Yep, as far as snowfall and different elevations of snowfall, definitely temperature changes. Yep.
Dare I ask, are you seeing them changes in the increase?
Well, locally,
the trends?
We look more at national trends and on a wider basis. And yeah, you were stating the information earlier about how
this past year was the second warmest on record.
Yes. We've had some definite temperature changes over the past few decades.
Right. Okay. We got just a couple more minutes. How did you get involved with the National Weather Service?
Well, I personally have been a soaring pilot for about 30 years now.
A what?
Soaring, hang gliding, and paragliding.
Okay.
Oh, wow. I did not expect that answer. That's a new one for us, okay. Lisa. That's
so
great.
Yeah, and it's super fun, and it really to be safe in a sport like that, you don't have motors as a backup, and you're in the air for a long time. I like to fly cross country routes that take me hundreds of miles in 6 or 7 hours to complete.
Wow!
And you really kind of live or die by your own forecast. So that got me really interested in forecasting for myself and for the area that I might be traveling in.
Wait a minute. When did you start this? I'm sorry.
We need a sidebar here to talk more about this.
Yeah, and how's the technology changed? What was that technology like when you first started?
Well, for hang gliding, that evolved, you know, in the 70s and 80s. By the time I got in 1989, it was pretty safe. They've had all the good technological advances that are keeping people safe, or safer.
Right.
And as far as aviation is concerned. Paragliding was a little newer, and I got into that at the end of the 90s, and that's been evolving. There's no frame in a paraglider, so it's pretty important that the equipment and the pilot judgment and everything is top-notch so you can keep as little risk as possible. But I'd say the equipment available now is it keeps your risk a lot lower than it had in the beginning.
So do you have any formal training in, you know, meteorological sciences? Do you or did you just come by that out of personal interest?
Yeah, I came by it just to want to make my own forecast to keep my risks low. And I use a lot of the National Weather Service products. And then I decided to actually go into the field. So I went to the U of U, got a meteorology degree, and then got an internship with the National Weather Service. So I became a meteorology intern there. But I found that I really like to be outside a lot more than inside. Mm-hmm. So that kind of that passion for being outdoors led me more toward this co-op program because I get to visit all of these stations and all of these people and work outdoors a lot more.
You do. And when you visit them, are you kind of just, what, checking up on them, checking their equipment, calibrating their equipment?
Yeah, exactly. I do the inspections once a year, but I also get to sit down with the observers and talk to them and find out their involvement in the program, you know, what they like and possibly what we can change for the future. And so it's a real interaction thing with each of these observers and their sites.
You must get to meet some amazing people.
I really do. There's quite a history. There's, like I said, there's many octogenarians, a few nonagenarians out there.
And wow.
They talk a lot about the history. I've got one guy that used to is a self-taught airplane pilot.
Wow.
And he's got some amazing stories from all over the state.
And it sounds like lots of rural areas as well. I mean, the majority of our state being very rural.
Yeah, there was a lot of agriculture interest back in the day. And so these observers would kind of become the local heroes. People would come up to them and ask them what the weather was every day, and they'd provide the information and the precipitation. So a lot of the ranchers and farmers depended on this information.
Sure. Now, when you say you paraglide, you're up for hours at a time, and you can go great distances, right? You're kind of at the whim of the wind and the conditions, some degree. I want you to land at one of your observers' locations.
Don't think I haven't thought of that. I have all the
just
GPS coordinates, and I usually ask permission if they minded if I, you know, came in. And most of them that have the big fields around are, no problem. And I know I can probably go in and get a hot drink and wait for my ride
and get a ride, right. You need a ride back.
That's great.
Wow. Okay, so we got to wrap up. But again, Lisa, your website, again, if people are interested in joining in on this observation program, again, it's Lisa.
The email address?
Email address, I'm sorry.
Lisa.Verzella at NOAA.gov.
Okay.
And at least you can contact the National Weather Service in Salt Lake City. Call them or email, and they will direct you to me.
Additionally, if you just Google, National Weather Service Cooperative Observer Program, you can get to kind of a homepage here with a little more data or a little more information about the program.
All right. I got to ask one more question about have you ever been in a situation where you got caught in an updraft and you're kind of not necessarily out of control, but you are now more at the control of that's happened?
I've been at the mercy of the elements more than I liked a number of times in kind of scary situations. But I've had enough luck on my side and foresight or skill, I guess, I hope, that I've managed to come out of my situations fine. And so I haven't had any of the big traumatic experiences that I know some people have. I've never flipped my glider. I've never had to throw my backup parachute yet.
Knock on wood.
But yeah, it's definitely something that you want to prepare as much as you can for.
Sure.
You know, we have products like the big product at the Weather Service is the Soaring Forecast. A lot of local flyers use that. There's about 200 members of the club here in Utah, Salt Lake, that use that forecast. And it really kind of helps delineate the atmosphere, the wind, the amount of instability, the turbulence that you might expect.
Yeah.
A soaring forecast. We're learning all kinds of unanticipated things.
I have not seen that tab on your website. Highest altitude you've gone?
Well, we're technically allowed to go to 17,999 feet.
Oh,
wow.
Because airspace for planes is at 18,000 and above. There are times for competitions or local events that we can ask the airport for clearance to go above that, and they will open up the windows sometimes up to 24,000 feet.
Wow.
I myself have been up to about 22. I carry oxygen.
Right.
It turns on about 10,000, so I'm fine. You know, I've got the food and the water, and I dress like I'm going skiing.
Yeah, so you have a parka.
Yeah. Oh.
A change of clothes. Okay. That's unbelievable. But there's still private aircraft that are flying at those lower altitudes. So you got to be – everybody's on the watch for – okay.
Yes.
That's fascinating. I'm sorry.
We could talk about this
took
all
a different
day.
Direction.
Like,
but
let's do another program.
Yeah,
that's right. Next time.
Yeah, it'd be great.
We'll get you on the mountain life with Lynn to talk about.
In the meantime, we'll take a quick break, and we have some news on this week's upcoming full moon, super moon, blue moon, lunar eclipse. We've
maybe,
got it all.
Maybe some nighttime paragliding to see the full moon.
That's right.
Lisa Versalli, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
All right, we'll be right back. This is Green Earth.
The Vail Epic Promise Foundation is a proud supporter of KPCW. The foundation provides Vail employees with grants in emergencies and for educational purposes. Information is available to Vail employees at epicpromise.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
I'm Chris Cherniak.
And we've got a couple minutes to wrap up today's show. And we wanted to mention a cool event that's going to happen tomorrow night.
What is that? Do I need to go outside for that?
You will have to go outside very early in the morning. But tomorrow night, January 31st, marks a full moon, a super moon, and also a lunar eclipse on the same night. It's also considered a blue moon, which is when there are two full moons in 1 month. But the appearance of the moon changes based on its position with the sun and the earth. A full moon occurs when one side of the moon is fully illuminated by the sun, as we know.
Right.
And the full moon is sort of the halfway point in the lunar cycle, which begins with the new moon,
okay,
when we don't see any moon. So we see the full moon every 29 days.
Right.
The super moon is a full moon in its closest orbital point to Earth, where it appears 14% larger and 30% brighter than average.
Wow.
So that's
so
why
it
looks so huge.
It's like 100 miles away from us?
I don't have
close?
That distance.
Okay.
On the top of my tongue. And then a lunar eclipse, of course, is when the moon passes through the Earth's shadow. And so the moon is expected to take on kind of like a darkish reddish hue. And that's because of some of the smoke and the particles in the Earth's atmosphere.
So all of this is happening tomorrow. All three of these things are happening?
Yes.
Tomorrow
night.
Is this apocalyptic?
Remains to
this
be seen.
This is a apocalyptic moon. Is that what you're saying?
This and I should say the best viewing time is at 6:29 a.m. I think it starts about an hour before that. And I should credit Rhea Cohn, who wrote up this summary about the moon.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's all tomorrow. Look, I'm going to guess you could look east. That'll help when you start your observations.
Absolutely.
That's where the moon rises. Okay.
Absolutely.
Right, Lisa?
Look east.
Just nod. Yes. So that's great. That's a rare event. It has to be extremely rare. Do we have any data about how often that happens?
Rarely.
Okay, there you go. And that's how we'll wrap things up on that. Mm-hmm. Thanks for that information. We got to wrap up, mm-hmm, as always, and thank our sponsors and underwriters who help make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain,
and of course, listeners like you.
You can always email us your thoughts, comments, and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org. And also, before we do our send-out tag, let's again thanks Margaret Bowman for joining us. She is the award winner of the John Campanius Home Award for Outstanding Service as a weather observer. And if you want to be a weather observer, you contact Lisa Verzelli at the National Weather Service. lisa.verzelli@noaa.gov. So, and thanks to Lisa for joining us. So, now.
Absolutely.
We have our takeaway.
It's now time to finally wrap up.
That's it.
You are listening to KPCW Radio 91.7 FM Park City. Remember, we've got your Wasatch back.
NPR News is coming up.